From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Director Allison Anders didn't come to filmmaking through your usual route. She was on welfare, a single mother with two teenage daughters, when she entered UCLA's film school. She had run away from home as a teenager to escape a brutal father. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Anders about the experiences that went into her new movie, Gas, Food, Lodging. Also, the frustrations of an advocate for the homeless who crossed over into city politics. We talk with Nancy Wackstein, who recently resigned from her position as director of the New York City Mayor's Office on Homelessness. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Death Becomes Her. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United States and Russia, co-sponsors of the Middle East peace process, are conferring with Israel and its Arab neighbors on a date for the next round of talks, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Israeli officials say August 24th has been suggested as a date for resumption of the talks, and the same date was cited by a Russian foreign ministry official in Beirut. But Israel, the Palestinians, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan have yet to reach a final decision on the date. When negotiations do resume, they'll take place in Washington, D.C. Up till now, each round of talks has lasted only a week or two, with the negotiators then returning home for consultations, and progress has been slow. This time, the negotiations may run continuously in an effort to achieve more rapid progress. The new Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, hopes for an agreement on Palestinian self-rule within a year. Mr. Rabin will confer with President Bush in Kennebunkport on August 10th. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The space shuttle Atlantis blasted into orbit this morning on a scientific mission that includes an effort to generate electricity with a tethered satellite. The seven astronauts aboard the shuttle are preparing to launch a satellite for the European Space Agency tomorrow. The Eureka satellite holds an array of experiments, including brine shrimp eggs and crystals that will be retrieved by another shuttle next spring. The main event of the seven-day mission will begin on Monday, when the crew releases a satellite held by a thin cable. Scientists believe the cable will generate electricity as it passes through the Earth's magnetic field. A Russian newspaper has published the names of 39 U.S. citizens believed to be imprisoned in Soviet penal camps during and after World War II. Some of the prisoners could still be alive. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The Americans named today came from many U.S. cities, including New York, Chicago, and Detroit. Among the 39 are 11 women and several children. Investigators for a joint Russian-American committee to determine the fate of American POWs held in the Soviet Union found the names and their cases in the archives of the KGB. All of those identified are believed to have been Americans of Slavic descent, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian. Many were born in the 1920s and 1930s and could be alive today. These Americans fell into the hands of the Red Army in the 1940s. Some were forced to renounce their American citizenship. Some refused. All were thrown into the camps. The Russian authorities say they believe some survived and have appealed to anyone in Russia with knowledge of these Americans to contact the investigating committee. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street, gaining for the fourth day in a row. The market showed little reaction to mixed economic news today, ranging from a rise in factory orders to the word that personal incomes remain stagnant. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points to close at 3,393.68. Advances narrowly outpaced declines. This is NPR News. Airport officials in Nepal say there's little chance that anyone survived the crash of a Thai Airways jet today in the foothills of the Himalayas. The plane slammed into a hillside in a heavy rain. It carried 113 people, including 11 Americans. A search team from the Nepalese Army found the wreckage of the plane in a remote valley about 30 miles south of Kathmandu. It was about a three-hour hike from the nearest road. Officials say the air search for survivors was called off because of darkness. New Jersey prosecutors say the driver of a bus that crashed there last weekend knew his brakes were bad before starting on a fatal trip to an amusement park. Six people were killed, and the driver now faces manslaughter charges. For member station WBGO, Tony Randolph reports.
The Sussex County prosecutor says Brooklyn bus driver Robert Campbell had his brakes checked only a few days before the fatal trip to an amusement park in New Jersey and knew that they needed work, but decided to take the trip anyway. The bus crashed when the brakes failed on a steep, winding rural highway. 6 people died and 47 were hurt. Funeral services for some of the victims were held this week as the governor and a congresswoman asked for funding for immediate improvements to the highway. Meanwhile, 3 of the injured have already filed lawsuits seeking $160 million from the driver and his company. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Randolph in Newark.
Federal health officials said today that mothers who smoked while pregnant are more than twice as likely to deliver underweight babies as mothers who did not smoke. The finding was part of a report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control that examined several health risks for newborns. The risk factors included the amount of weight gained by mothers during pregnancy, the amount of prenatal care, and whether the babies were delivered normally or by cesarean section. Regardless of all other risk factors, though, the CDC said that women who smoked while pregnant were more likely to deliver underweight babies. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gas Food Lodging is a new movie about a single mother and her 2 teenage daughters living together in a cramped trailer in Laramie, New Mexico. The mother, played by Brooke Adams, is a waitress in a truck stop, barely getting by on her salary. She doesn't want her daughters to get trapped like she did. But her oldest daughter, played by Ione Skye, seems headed for trouble. She sleeps around, doesn't go to school, and doesn't have a job. She fights with her mother constantly. The movie was written and directed by my guest Allison Anders. Though Gas Food Lodging is based on a novel by Richard Peck, the family Anders created for the movie is largely drawn from her own family life when she was growing up. Some of the fights between the mother and the daughter in the film came directly out of Anders' childhood.
There's one fight with Brooke Adams and Ione Skye in the hallway where Ione's been out late and she comes in and the mom confronts her. And it was scripted up to a point, but Brooke had gone and videotaped my mother to prepare for her character. And after a while, they were improvising in the rehearsal. And one of the things that happened was that Brooke screamed at Ione, you've got 3 choices. You go to school, you get a job, or you get out. And when she said that, I thought, oh, my God, this is my mom. So I loved it, and I said, well, let's just go with it. You know, let's continue on just what you were doing. And but my little sister was working on the film, and when she was working in wardrobe, and she came in to lay out some clothes into the trailer, and when she heard Brooke screaming, you go to school, you get a job, or you get out, she just dropped the clothes and ran out of the trailer.
It had that kind of reaction.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what did you say when your mother said that to you?
Well, it was funny because my mother, in telling Brooke about this, she says, I always told the girls they had 3 choices. You go to school, you get a job, or you get out. And she said, and they all got out. So, you know, and that was pretty much what had happened. I mean, but the volatile fights were definitely things that my mother and I went through, and my sisters and my mom went through.
Do those fights replay differently looking back on them as a mother yourself?
You know, they're pretty similar, actually. I mean, for the most part, my oldest daughter and I went through this when she was about 13. You know, I think the hardest thing for me was she was not quite as obsessed with finding her father as I was with finding mine. I'm trying to find that connection. I think that for her, she was raised around so many kids who also were had single moms as the head of the household, that I don't know that she felt the same kind of alienation that I felt. But our fights tended to be just more her trying to separate herself from me, which was really hard. I think the hardest thing for me was being regarded as not cool enough, you know, which was really hard, you know, so...
Not cool enough. Your daughters thought you weren't cool enough.
Yeah.
This is after you'd run away from left home to go to a commune in England and
right.
This really independent, hip life.
Right, exactly.
And suddenly you're not cool enough for your young daughters.
Exactly. That really hurt.
It's really fascinating to watch my contemporaries go through this with their children.
Yeah, it's really, you know, I've got, fortunately now I have other parents that I can bond with on this. You know, I know that I have one friend who our daughters were friends with each other and went to the same school, and he was raising her by himself. The mother had raised her for a while, and now he was raising her alone. And he was so amazed that I got to go out to the school. I said, I went out and saw our kids yesterday at the on campus, and he goes, she let you go out there? And I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, I don't get to go out. I have to drop her off. Because I said, why? And he goes, I'm just not cool enough. And this guy had, you know, run like a really intense alternative record store and was, you know, a DJ and, you know, had all the what I would certainly consider very groovy requirements. But it's just funny to watch them separate from you. And the fights are really, I just think that in a way it's part of that separation.
Now, I know you grew up in a trailer, right?
I lived in a trailer for a few years of my life, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the family lives in your movie. What's it like to live in a trailer?
Well, it's really a really strange, strange environment because it's very, very crowded, you know, and no matter how much space you think you have, you really are really confined. And the production designer on Gas Food Lodging actually went out and found set dressing that was in the trailer that I lived in when I was a kid, these sort of generic Americana paintings, this real idyllic kinds of Americana scenes, and which do not fit in trailer parks at all. It's the absolute opposite of what the life in a trailer park is like. So that was pretty wild after a while to realize that this environment was exactly created as a one where I was actually a teenager, like Trudy at the time, that played by Ione Skye. I was actually the more confrontational teenager at the time that I was living in the trailer.
Ione Skye is also the more sexually assertive of the two daughters. She sleeps around a lot. Were you very sexually assertive too when you were young?
Well, I had a lot of the same. I had the same with her character. I really wanted to show that there was a kind of acting out that was a result of being violated sexually, and I really wanted to get into that because I had had that experience myself. And so there was a lot of acting out on my part, especially when I was in my adolescence. Well, on up until I had my first relationship at 18. And so I really identified with that stuff a lot. And, you know, even the painful part of it for her, I really wanted to put that on the screen because I wanted to get away from this idea that there are good girls and bad girls. You know, for me, there's girls that were very, very fortunate, and it's certainly the way that it should be, is that you have a safe place to explore your sexuality, and then there are girls whose boundaries are violated, and, you know, after that, the only alternative you really have until you learn to heal from sexual abuse is this kind of acting out that's doesn't have proper boundaries at all.
Well, the character was gang raped.
Right.
Now that's happened before the movie began, so we find out about it. That's what happened to you?
That's right. When I was 12.
Must have just changed your life immediately and profoundly.
It absolutely had a profound effect. And it's continuing to have a really profound effect on me. I don't think the effects of it will ever not be a part of my life. But hopefully now it's I have more of a survivor mentality than a victim mentality. But I certainly went through the periods of being very victimized by that experience.
Did you blame yourself for it?
Absolutely. And there wasn't the resources available that there are now at that time. I mean, I didn't even know the word for what had happened to me. I didn't even know how to say, well, I was raped. I didn't know what to call it. to me, it was just for years, it was this bad thing that happened kind of thing was how I described it. There was this bad thing that happened to me. And it wasn't until I was 15 that I learned what the word was for what had happened to me. So, and the shame that comes with that is it can be extremely paralyzing. So, and you know, can end up causing a lot of self-destructive behavior.
Did you know the boys and did you see them again?
Yeah, I knew the boys. They were teenagers themselves. They were in my school. And, yeah, that was really tough because actually everybody knew about it in the town. But it was, and these boys had actually violated other girls as well. But nobody, there was just no, I don't know what would have happened if we had reported it, really. I mean, I have no idea. It was just unheard of. We just didn't. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was pretty much the blame was put on the girls, you know. So I was pretty much blamed for what had happened.
You had a lot of rough experiences when you were growing up. If this is accurate, what I read was that your stepfather, when you were, I think, 15 or something, pulled a gun on you.
Mm-hmm.
What was that about?
Well, at the time, he was drunk. He doesn't even remember the incident. So, there was a lot of alcohol abuse in my family, and everyone's fine now. But he was drunk and pulled a gun on my mother and my sister and I. And eventually he passed out, and we were able to get away from him. My mom dismantled the gun, and we fled to Los Angeles. That's actually how I got to Los Angeles. We were living in Phoenix, Arizona at the time. And so that was what happened there.
Let me bring up something else that happened to you when you were young. I think when you were a teenager, you, I think, had tried to commit suicide. You were institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you used to hear voices, perhaps. Were you diagnosed as schizophrenic? Or?
Well, I wasn't. I think they diagnosed it at the time as adolescent adjustment or adolescent maladjustment or something like that, which they've later termed as situational schizophrenia. So it was, what happened was that after the incident after we ran away from my stepfather, we went out to Los Angeles, and I felt like we were finally free of a kind of abusive tyranny that was going on in the home. And my mother found out that she was pregnant with my youngest sister. And she called my stepfather back into our lives. And at that point, I just couldn't really. I found it impossible to live in that situation, but I also couldn't get out. So the way that I got out was to sort of check out mentally and emotionally. And it was around the time that there was this Paul McCartney is dead rumor and scandal and stuff. So I was really into finding out the clues, and I'd always been a pretty hardcore Paul McCartney fan, still am. And so I got really involved in that. And eventually the way that my breakdown manifested was that I began to believe that I was communicating with Paul McCartney, that Paul McCartney was dead, and I was like had this personal relationship with him. And also with 13 other characters. And I talked out loud to them. And it also manifested with catatonia some of the time. And eventually manifested in a hysterical pregnancy, which I said the father of the baby was Paul McCartney and all this stuff. So I was institutionalized, which was really great because it got me out of the situation, it was really great protection for me. I was in a really good hospital that was real progressive at the time. And there were people there that just really cared for me. There was a poet who really tried to help me write, and it was really difficult at the time because I just didn't have the structure I needed to really put my thoughts down on paper. But she was very encouraging. And then there was another woman who really saved me from, from thoughts of suicide. Well, not from thoughts of suicide, but from actually succeeding, I think.
So you felt fortunate to be institutionalized because it got you out of a miserable home life. But what happened when they let you go, when they felt that you'd improved enough to release you?
Well, that was hard because then they didn't want to send me back to my parents' home. And at that point, my mother had given birth to my little sister. And my pregnancy disappeared when hers disappeared. And so they placed me in a foster home, which was not a very good place for me to be. And eventually I ran away from the foster home, ran back home to my mother, and then eventually ran away from that home as well. So running away from home was really, really good for me because when I went out on the road, I had to take care of myself completely. I mapped out my trip from Los Angeles to, well, the first time to Arizona, and then the second time all the way to Kentucky, which I hitchhiked half of that distance. And, I had to take care of myself along the road, had to trust people, had to let people close to me. And eventually all the characters that I had in this fantasy world, I dropped off along the road. And by the time that I got to Kentucky, I only had Paul left. And he then confessed that he actually wasn't really Paul McCartney. He was just a regular dead guy. And that wasn't very appealing to me. I just thought, well, if you're not a rock star, then there's plenty of live guys out here, right? So that was the end of that. I became completely lucid again, and that was sort of my healing process had come to an end there. And now the irony is that it's exactly what my job is now, is to create characters. And sometimes I do talk out loud to them if I'm really stumped.
My guest is Allison Anders. She wrote and directed the new movie Gas Food Lodging. It stars Brooke Adams and Ione Skye. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Film director Allison Anders is my guest. Shortly after you left home for good and went on the road, as I think when you became pregnant with your first daughter, and, you know, you gave birth out of wedlock, did you want to be a mother at that point?
Yeah, you know, I was always very attracted to the idea, and I used to say that when I was a teenager, I was always saying I wanted 15 children. But I did stop at 2. I was always really into that whole idea. I really wanted to have, specifically, I wanted to have daughters. But, I really wanted to be a mom.
Let me skip ahead. I know you went back to school after you became a mother and eventually went to film school. And as a film student, you became really involved with the films of the German director Wim Wenders and started communicating with him. I'm wondering what kind of letters you sent him and if you were sending him the kind of obsessive fan letters that tend to actually scare the people who receive the letters.
No, I don't think that it was like that. They were really personal letters, actually. But pretty early on, I mean, I think the first letter that I sent him was about his films, or the films that I'd seen at that point. But after that, they were just about, you know, stuff that I was doing or thinking about. He read every single letter that I sent him, and which, if you knew how many I sent him, it was pretty phenomenal that he read them all. And he even read the script of my very first film at UCLA. He had read it in such detail that when I talked to him on the phone, I said, I did my last shot of my movie today. I finished shooting. And he said, what was your last shot? He says, you see, because I know the script so well. you could tell me what the last shot was and I will know. So it was pretty amazing. I mean, he read absolutely everything that I wrote.
What was the first letter that you sent him?
The first letter I sent him was after I saw Lightning Over Water, and I was just so completely... It was a film that really changed how I perceived film. I loved that it was realism and that it was also not realism at all, and something about it for me just really kicked in. And I wrote to him all about that film and how much I loved it. And I also sent him some girl group music that I really liked on a tape, which all my friends thought was really weird. They were like, to a film director? Film directors don't like that stuff. But he really loved it, and I somehow knew that it was the right thing to do.
You ended up working on Wim Wenders' movie Paris, Texas, as, I think, a production assistant. How did you get the job with him?
Well, what happened was one day Wim called me and said, Allison, this is Wim Wenders. I'm going to be in Los Angeles, and I wonder if you could find time to show me your film. So at that point, I was at UCLA, and I made my very first film at UCLA. And, of course, I said, well, I don't know, maybe. But I was just in absolute, I was completely high on the idea that he was going to come, and I was finally going to meet him. So so we set up a screening at UCLA, and he came to UCLA and saw my first film. And then meanwhile, I had already applied for a grant saying that he had invited me to study on the set of Paris, Texas, which he knew nothing about, but I did win the grant. So when he came to UCLA and saw my film, I showed him that I had won this grant. I said, look, I won this grant. And he says, oh, that's wonderful. Congratulations. And I said, well, it's so that I can study under you. So he said, oh, my God, I can't believe you did this. Well, of course you can come.
In all of our talking about your early life, I neglected to really ask you how movies became really important to you.
Well, I started going to movies by myself when I was 7 in Kentucky. And I would just see whatever was playing, you know. And it's funny to think of what films were really important to me. I also watched old movies, quote-unquote women's movies, on TV with my grandmother. And so I saw a lot of really great, like, Betty Davis movies and, you know, some of the wonderful old melodramas. So I really love melodrama very, very much. And those films definitely had a big impact on me and continue to do so. And the films that I saw when I was a kid in the early 60s were like Breakfast at Tiffany's or Lolita Came to Town and I couldn't go, and I threw an absolute fit that I couldn't get in to see it. I had no idea what it was, but I really liked the poster. I thought it was really cool. So, those films definitely had a huge effect and I continued to be a pretty avid moviegoer throughout my adolescence and teenage years.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Allison Anders wrote and directed the new movie Gas, Food, Lodging. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nancy Waxstein used to think that the problem of homelessness could be solved by more housing, but she doesn't think that anymore. Waxstein is the former director of New York City's Office of Homelessness and Single-Room Occupancy Housing. She resigned from the job last fall. Before that, she was an advocate for the homeless. Coming up, we talk about how her views on homelessness changed when she went to work for the city and why she eventually left her job in frustration. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Death Becomes Her, the new movie starring Meryl Streep, Bruce Willis, and Goldie Hawn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Associated Press, quoting Pentagon sources, says that the Bush administration is getting ready to send at least 600 soldiers to Kuwait and possibly more. According to this report, soldiers from Fort Hood in Texas and Fort Stewart in Georgia have been given orders to get ready for the move. The Pentagon source is quoted as saying, "The step is to show the flag and is a message to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein." Officials of the U.S. and Russia have issued invitations to the next round of Middle Eastern peace talks to take place in Washington August 24th. The sixth round of talks will be the first since the Israeli general elections in June. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials have confirmed they will take part in the next session. Last week, representatives from Arab countries participating in the talks met and agreed to attend. Unlike the limited format of the past, this next round of face-to-face talks between Israel and its Arab neighbors is planned to continue for a month. The negotiations, which began last October in Madrid, have so far made little progress. The new Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, has pledged to accelerate the pace of the peace process and negotiate an autonomy agreement with the Palestinians. In a rare interview with an Israeli newspaper, PLO leader Yasser Arafat says he's willing to meet Rabin, but concedes it is unlikely Rabin would be willing to meet him. All Israeli governments, including Rabin's, consider the PLO a terror group and refuse to negotiate with it. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Police in Colombia say that they have uncovered a plot to kill Justice Minister Andre Gonzalez. Two suspects have been arrested. Officials don't say who they believe is behind the operation, but suspicion is bound to include members of the Medellin drug cartel. Bernard Gabani reports from Bogota.
The police statement said that two private security guards working in the Justice Ministry building in Bogota were preparing a plan to kill Mr. Gonzalez. It also says they were going to receive a large amount of money for their work. According to the daily newspaper El Tiempo, the plot was discovered last Monday, 5 days after the drugs trafficker Pablo Escobar escaped from a prison near the city of Medellin. In 1984, the government began its first clampdown on traffickers after the then Justice Minister was assassinated. That was when Escobar first went into hiding. In 1987, a former Justice Minister was almost killed in Hungary. And last year, another former Justice Minister was shot dead in Bogota. For National Public Radio, this is Bernard Gabani in Bogota, Colombia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 2 points to close at 3,393.68. On volume of more than 174 million shares, advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. An inspector for the National Transportation Safety Board says there may have been an engine problem prior to last night's fire on board a TWA jet at New York's Kennedy Airport. Investigators also believe a long trail of fuel on the runway indicates a possible ruptured fuel line fed the fire, which burned half of the jumbo jet. There were 292 people in the plane, but all survived, with only 55 people suffering minor injuries. However, inspectors still say it's too early to say what caused the blaze that caused the L-1011 to abort its takeoff. A French public prosecutor has demanded a 4-year sentence and a $100,000 fine for the health official accused in a trial involving the distribution of AIDS-contaminated blood products. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
This case is one of the biggest medical scandals in French history. The prosecution charges that in the mid-1980s, health officials gave hemophiliacs blood products that they knew were contaminated with the AIDS virus. Since then, more than 250 hemophiliacs have died from AIDS, and another 1,200 are infected with the virus. The prosecutor said that the head of the Blood Transfusion Center, Michel Garreta, should be given the maximum sentence. He's not denied the charges, but insists he wasn't the only one responsible. The prosecutor has called for suspended sentences for the other three health officials who've also been on trial. During the hearings, three former cabinet officials, including a former prime minister, testified. Hemophiliacs say they should also be tried for consumer fraud. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The space shuttle Atlantis is now in orbit after a morning liftoff from Cape Canaveral. On board are seven astronauts who will fly a satellite on a 12-mile string in order to generate electricity. Another shuttle flight will recapture the satellite next spring so that samples on board may be studied. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Nancy Wackstein spent years as an activist working on behalf of the homeless. When David Dinkins offered her a job heading his new office on homelessness and single-room occupancy housing, it seemed like a great opportunity for her to implement some of her ideas. For example, she'd always believed that homelessness could be solved by providing more affordable permanent housing. But inside the administration, everything seemed more complicated, more difficult. In less than 2 years, Wackstein resigned out of frustration. She's currently the executive director of a social service agency. I asked her how the issue of homelessness looked different when she was inside city politics.
Just by virtue of having responsibility for making sure that people are sheltered or housed or fed or whatever your responsibility is a major burden. When you're on the outside and you talk about what should be done, you can sort of say it's hypothetically, and you can be idealistic, and you can say this is what should happen. And then when you're on the inside, you have to make it happen. And it's sort of the buck stops here. And it's a much different burden. It's a much different responsibility. I took my responsibilities as a government official seriously. We are there to serve the people, and it's easy. It's really easy to say what should be done, but then when you have to try to come up with the ways to do it and get around the regulations and come up with the money and get everybody to and overcome the political resistance, it's more complicated than just saying, do it.
You worked on a plan to reform the Armory Shelter system in Manhattan. For our listeners who don't know about the Armory Shelter, tell us why it needed to be changed or needs to be changed.
The New York City system for homeless single adults, these are people who do not have children with them, most of whom are men. There is this vast network, unfortunately, that's existed for about 8 to 10 years now of totally unacceptable facilities. These are facilities that were never intended to house people. They're facilities that are, you know, offer no privacy, no area for services, inadequate sanitary, whatever. So it was one of the things that the mayor said when he was running for mayor that he wanted to see eliminated. So we came up with a 5-year plan for closing down the armories by substituting for them smaller residential buildings, still transitional housing, but where people would actually receive help. Is a discredited concept around of rehabilitation, but our belief was that people could become ready for permanent housing if they went through some sort of transitional rehabilitative program, whether it was a mental health program or a drug program or an employment program. And so we proposed smaller residential buildings that would be created for this purpose and therefore would be better physically.
Then you had to figure out where to put them.
Then we had to figure out where to put them. And that was when we ran into our political firestorm. That was just around the time that I left. In the city, many of the armory-type facilities are located in the poorest neighborhoods because that's where the city-owned property, that's where the armories were located, that's where I guess if you want to be cynical about it, that's where there was no political resistance to putting them there. We felt, and the city has a charter which says that you have to consider, quote unquote, fair share when you site these kinds of facilities, meaning each community has to do its fair share or should do its fair share and not more. And So we selected neighborhoods that were not the same poor minority neighborhoods. We selected neighborhoods that were more middle class around the city.
And you got a lot of resistance.
Which were not oversaturated with these facilities already, and we got a lot of resistance. And I think, unfortunately, that plan will never go forward.
You got that much resistance?
Yeah, yeah. You know, we got it actually from the right and from the left. From the right, or quote-unquote the right, there were communities who said, well, we don't want those people in this neighborhood because most of the homeless people here are African-American and Latino, and a lot of them are men, so they're the most threatening part of population, I guess, most people feel in these neighborhoods. And the and then from the left, the advocates were saying, the sort of liberal advocates were saying, well, why are you going to put up these transitional facilities? Why don't you just build permanent housing? So the plan was sort of doomed from both sides. And unfortunately, the sad thing to me now is that, well, you know, 2 years have passed and the homeless people are still in the armories and nothing. So for all this political debate and philosophical debate, are the homeless people better off or worse? And unfortunately, they're not better off.
Let me ask you, I know you had published something called A Shelter Is Not a Home.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that was an argument against relying too much on temporary shelters. Mm-hmm. So here you are now in the position of saying, no, let's build more temporary shelters in order to get people out of the armory.
I'll tell you, I think my views changed because the Shelter Is Not a Home report talked about homeless families, not single individuals. But I think what changed, or what I began to realize more than I had, is that many, many of the homeless families and homeless people we were dealing with were not able to move right into a permanent home. The incidence of substance abuse, you know, the great thing you're not supposed to talk about, it's very high. And it was my view that someone should not just be placed in a permanent home because it would, in a sense, really make it unpleasant for a lot of neighbors in the same way you don't want somebody who is not able to maintain their apartment or themselves as your neighbor. I didn't think it was a good thing to put homeless people in apartments without their having assistance first and dealing with some of the functioning problems.
What was it like for you to change your mind? I mean, some people are very resistant to changing their mind. You know, it's a difficult thing to do because it challenges what you believe, and it's admitting that maybe you were wrong about something.
Absolutely, I went through a period of crisis about it. There's no question. I said, oh my God, I'm turning into a neoconservative. I mean, I'm turning into, a welfare basher or something. And I had spent my whole this is my profession. You know, mm-hmm. I had spent my whole life trying to get more, for poor people. And so I had some crisis of confidence. And then, for whatever reasons, I feel comfortable that I did what was realistic, really. I mean, when you're in government, you're on the firing line, you don't have the luxury of idealizing or romanticizing a problem. Because you have to deal with the hard reality of it, and the hard reality is no housing group is going to house someone with a drug problem, and you can say that shouldn't be the case or that's terrible, but that's the fact. The city becomes the provider of last resort, and that's why I guess I changed my mind that we needed these kinds of programs that would stabilize people.
My guest is Nancy Wackstein, former director of the New York City Mayor's Office on Homelessness. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nancy Wackstein. She's worked on behalf of the homeless as an activist and within the New York City Mayor's Office. Were you, while you were with the city administration on the opposite side of any issues, from former colleagues that you had when you were a homeless activist.
Sure, sure I did. Sure I was.
What was it like for you?
Oh, it was hard. You know, these are people that I had grown up with professionally, more or less. These were some of the people who told me to take this job. They said, when Dinkins became mayor, they said, oh, great, Nancy, you have an obligation now to us, to the field, to do this. And I did. And then, of course, people... You very quickly, not because of who I was or who I am personally, but you assume your institutional role. I'm representing the institution. So the lawsuits are, you know, against me as well as anybody else. And you become defensive. I was pretty public about some of the conflicts I was having. So it wasn't like I changed overnight from a good person to a bad person. I think most of my colleagues knew what some of the struggles were, and privately would be supportive, but publicly had to say what their institutional roles required.
Now let's talk about the issue of single-room occupancies. And these are basically units in old hotels that have become, like, quote, welfare hotels. Mm-hmm. Now, you had been head of an emergency alliance for homeless families, and you were the former advisor for the Citizens Committee for Children, which dealt a lot with homeless children. Mm-hmm. So having worked as an activist on the issue of homeless mm-hmm. families, were you trying to keep people out of SROs? I mean, the single-room occupancies. I wonder if your attitude about single-room occupancies shifted when you entered the city administration.
No, actually, that's one thing that was very consistent. I thought at the time that when I was outside government, I thought welfare hotels, so-called welfare hotels, commercial hotel rooms were lousy places for families with children, and I still thought that when I was inside government. However, we, again, were required to shelter every family that came to our door, came knocking on the door and said, I'm homeless. So we quickly ran out of places that were more appropriate. There are about 5,000 homeless families, probably about 5,300 homeless families right now in the city. And every night, we shelter people who come to request emergency housing. And so when you run out of more appropriate kinds of places, and I had advocated quite strenuously that there be a whole network of nonprofit kind of shelters with services and privacy built up, we ran out of those. Guess what? You found yourself using welfare hotels because you had to shelter people and there was no place else to put them. And it always seemed that we were behind the eight ball, that you could never keep up with the numbers. You get very driven by numbers in a job like that. You know, you begin to focus less on the quality of the accommodations or the sheltering facility. We just say, oh, well, we just have to house everybody. And so you turn to places that are not ideal.
Did you end up thinking, why is it the city that is responsible for this?
Absolutely.
Why not the state? Why not the federal government?
Yeah, well, you know, it's sort of naive to think that any city is going to solve this problem, because what it's going to take to solve this problem is solving the problem of poverty, drug abuse, unemployment, poor housing, all of the above. So, of course, the city can't do it. I don't think I need to tell you or the listeners of public radio that we have not had an administration in Washington that particularly cares. Until there's a riot, of course, and then we'll throw a little money at a situation and then we'll forget about it. So, you know, I'm in it for the long term, and in long term, there's been no leadership at all.
Now, what have you decided is the right place for you to work?
This is a good question. I am now the executive director of a community-based, nonprofit, multi-service social agency, and I think that that's a very good place for me to be now. We do a variety of services, ranging from toddlers to elderly and a lot of people in between, including homeless people. We have some wonderful services for homeless people among our many services. You feel a little, it's not the macro problem anymore. I don't have to deal with 35,000 homeless people. I don't have to feel guilty when I walk down the street and I see somebody sleeping on the street thinking that I failed, which I did for a couple of years. And so at my agency, we deal with maybe a couple hundred homeless people a year. And if we can do a good job with those people, I feel like I'm still doing something important. In the nonprofit world, however, as most people know, there's a constant scramble for money. So it's not like it's lightened up in that regard either. They're still with those budget problems. But so, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to raise money to support our programs. But I think that, you know, I didn't, after leaving the mayor's office, I didn't give up on social welfare. I didn't drop out and work in a health food store. I'm now the director of a social service agency, and it's a little more real. It's a little more doable because we're dealing with much smaller numbers. And I don't have, you know, I don't have communities hating me and denouncing me because I wanted to do something to help the homeless in our community because we've been a part of this community for so long. It's the name of the agency is the Lenox Hill Neighborhood Association. We've been part of this community for almost 100 years. What we do, the community wants. It's nice to be wanted because for years, I was, as I said, attacked and denounced, and it's nice to run a service that people like and people want.
One last question. Would you ever be comfortable as an activist pressuring the city again?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would. I think I know enough to know how the other side feels and reacts. I think I could be such a good advocate now because I've been on the other side. And I will. I think that there are certain things that should be done and not done. I think when I was an outside advocate, I always tried to be constructive, and I would try to be constructive now. It doesn't help. When you're in government, it doesn't help to hear what you shouldn't do. What we always were dying to hear is, well, what do people think we should do? What are the solutions? Because everybody under the sun will tell you what you shouldn't do and why what you're doing is wrong. And I was always sitting in meetings saying, well, what do you propose? What are the alternatives? So I wouldn't be an advocate again until I had something to offer to help the people, the policymakers, the decision makers, because they, I think, need some constructive ideas which recognize the constraints under which they operate.
Nancy Wackstein is the former director of the New York City Mayor's Office on Homelessness, and she now directs the Lenox Hill Neighborhood Association. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. President Bush is campaigning in California. We'll have the president speaking on welfare tonight. California cannot afford to offer kindergarten to all the kids who used to qualify for it. We'll have something on that. We're going to provide some things you may need to know to understand hip-hop culture and rap music. And we're also looking into a beach novel, a summer movie, and a couple of critics who will talk to us about how NBC's doing covering the Olympics.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Robert Zemeckis has become one of the most reliable hitmakers in Hollywood with the Back to the Future films and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But will his hot streak continue? Film critic Stephen Schiff took a look at Zemeckis' latest picture, Death Becomes Her.
The special effects in Death Becomes Her are absolutely terrific. Meryl Streep struts through a room with her head twisted backward. Goldie Hawn walks around with a hole in her midriff so huge that you could throw a football through it. And when Goldie bonks Meryl with a shovel, Meryl's neck disappears completely, and her head gets half buried beneath her shoulders. This is the sort of stuff that will strike your average 13-year-old boy as not only excellent, but downright awesome. And I won't argue with that. Awesome it is. It's not, however, worth sitting through Death Becomes Her for. To anyone who remembers such not-so-awesome catfight movies as Old Acquaintance, Rich and Famous, and The Turning Point, Death Becomes Her will look pretty familiar. It's the old story of girlfriends who become bitter rivals, fighting over men, over career, and especially over who looks better for her age. In this case, Streep plays Madeline, a third-rate Broadway and movie star. She steals the eminent Dr. Ernest Menville, played by Bruce Willis, from his first love, Streep's pal Helen, played by Goldie Hawn. 14 years later, Hawn has become a successful author, and Streep's star has faded. Meanwhile, her marriage to Willis has become loveless to the point of homicide. That's when Hahn takes her revenge. She seduces Willis and urges him to go ahead and kill Streep, though she needn't. Willis is so frustrated with Streep that he throws her down the stairs. It's a lethal fall, but not lethal enough.
Ernest! Ernest! You pushed me down the stairs.
Stay away from me!
You bet I will, animal, psycho!
Don't come near me!
Wife! Pusher!
Don't come near me or follow me! Don't come near me or follow me or talk to me!
I don't intend to. I just have to make a telephone call. 911, right?
Wrong. Not even 911 can save this movie. It turns out that Streep has taken a potion that not only makes her younger, it makes her immortal. Nothing can kill or even harm her, though she can get pretty bent out of shape. When Hahn swallows the same stuff, it looks as though these two harpies will have to spend eternity bickering at each other. And by the time the movie's half over, we know pretty well how that eternity will feel. Zemeckis has much the same problem that Steven Spielberg has. He's great at fashioning movies for children, but when he tries to make movies for grown-ups, they simply look childish. Death Becomes Her may think it's some sort of blistering black comedy about female vanity, but what it really is another trip to Roger Rabbit's Toontown, where the characters are indestructible cartoons who scream at each other all day long. Co-screenwriter David Koepp has said that his idea was a kind of Night of the Living Dead, but with script by Noel Coward. Wishful thinking. Death Becomes Her is an endless, misogynistic dynasty episode, with Alexis and Crystal kicking and pulling each other's hair. Script by Daffy Duck.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, editing a news magazine in a state penitentiary, we talk with Wilbert Rideau, editor of The Angleite in Louisiana's Angola State Penitentiary. He's serving a life sentence for murder. His news magazine has won some of journalism's most prestigious awards. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.